Jennifer Traeg spent a lot of her adolescent and teen years washing her hands over and over and spent very little time eating. She had obsessive-compulsive disorder, OCD, and everything she did all the way, including praying and following Jewish law. As she says, suddenly I wasn't just washing myself, I was purifying myself from sin. Traeg's new memoir is called Devil in the Details, Scenes from an Obsessive Girlhood. She's a frequent contributor to McSweeney's Internet Tendency and The Forward. Let's start with a reading from the beginning of Traeg's book.
My father and I were in the laundry room, and we were having a crisis. It was the strangest thing, but I couldn't stop crying. And there were a few other weird things. I was wearing a yarmulke and a nightgown, for one. And then there were my hands, red and raw and wrapped in plastic baggies. My lip was split. There were paper towels under my feet. And weirdest of all, everything I owned seemed to be in the washing machine. Whites and colors, clothes and shoes, barrettes and backpacks, all jumbled together. Huh. Huh, my father said, examining the Reebok Esprit Hello Kitty stew churning through permanent press. You want to tell me what happened here? Wasn't it obvious? The fumes from the bacon my sister had microwaved for dessert had tainted everything I owned, so now it all had to be washed. But this sort of rational explanation hadn't been going over well with my father lately. I scrambled to think of another, turning lies over in my mouth. It was homework, an experiment. It was performance art, a high-concept piece protesting the consumerization of tweens. I glanced up at my father and down at the machine, then dragged my baggied wrist under my nose and exhaled. I don't know.
When your father came upon you and your hands were bloodied and wrapped in baggies and there were paper towels underneath your feet and you were washing everything you owned and you were wearing your yarmulke and your nightgown, did anything seem wrong to you?
I think that was really the point where I looked at myself and knew this is not what 12 years old looks like, that I should be, you know, out romping around and in little Izod play suits and having a great time with my friends. And instead, I was up to my elbows in Clorox. So I definitely knew things had gotten out of hand.
You eventually found out that you had, among other things, a type of obsessive-compulsive disorder that's known as scrupulosity, which I had never heard of before. What is it?
Yeah, it's not at all rare, but it is very obscure. In fact, it's so little known that my publisher actually made sure it was a real disease before they bought my book. No one's heard of it, but it's, in fact, the oldest form of OCD. And basically, it's simply religious OCD. You do the exact same things you do with any other kind of OCD, like tap or wash or check, but you do them because either you think the Bible tells you to or because God will punish you if you don't. So everything has this sort of religious framework. And it's been around forever. There are records of monks with scrupulosity from the 6th century. By the 12th century, the Catholic Church had named it. Martin Luther had it, John Bunyan, St. Teresa.
Is scrupulosity considered a disorder or just a very committed form of devotion?
Certainly, early on, it was seen as a virtue. After a while, as the scrupulous wore down their clergy with, you know, constant need to confess and just nagging doubts and worries all the time, everyone started to get that maybe this isn't a good thing. Maybe this is actually something that needs treatment. And the church was the first group to realize that and to prescribe a protocol for priests to deal with their scrupulous parishioners.
Now, your father is Jewish, your mother is Catholic. You became
exactly.
An Orthodox Jew when you were in your early teens. What was it about religion that seemed to that attracted you so much?
Well, I loved having the structure, and even still, I mean, having my choices taken away is just fabulous for me. I really liked the order of it. I was, you know, a fairly serious child, and, you know, had I been Catholic, I certainly would have been a nun, because I was raised Jewish. I chose Orthodoxy. I liked the sense of community it offered. I liked always knowing what I would need to do at any given time of the day.
But it seems to me when you were young and becoming Orthodox, there were things that you did that were based on a total misunderstanding of the religion.
Oh, absolutely. And that, I think, had less to do with my OCD than the fact that, you know, I grew up in this small Northern California farm town. There were almost no Jews. My mother was Catholic, so I really didn't get a whole lot of Jewish education. And most of it was just stuff I picked up on my own, you know, just reading my junior Jewish encyclopedia, reading I Loved All of a Kind Family, The Jazz Singer, that movie I watched over and over, the remake with Neil Diamond. And that is really what I based my religious practice on. So it was this strange religion that looked sort of like Judaism, but everything was just slightly off.
For instance, you were wearing a yarmulke, and women don't wear yarmulkes.
No, exactly. But, you know, Neil Diamond had, so it seemed like a good idea.
When you got deeply into Judaism and you were living in a predominantly non-Jewish town, in order to become an Orthodox Jew, you had to officially convert to Judaism.
Yeah, exactly. I had to go through the whole process, which at 12, it was not maybe really what I wanted to do. I mean, you have to, it does at some point involve nudity. You have to go to the ritual bath, go to the mikvah, and that part I could have lived without. But, you know, it was something I had to, I kind of felt like it was having a sex change, you know, that my identity was as a Jew, and I had to go through this procedure to make my identity and my actual life match. So I was happy to do it.
Although you turned to Orthodox Judaism, your mother's Catholic, did she think mm-hmm. about the saints at all and their commitment or obsessions?
Not so much. She and my father got married, they made an agreement that the kids would be raised Jewish, and she mostly kept her practice to herself. She's devout and you know, prays all the time and goes to church every week and invokes Saint Anthony a lot for lost things. And you knew you were in a lot of trouble when she was bringing up Saint Jude, patron saint of lost causes. That was when you knew you had it coming. But for the most part, no, she was actually really good about trying to find me Jewish women role models, and would always mention if we saw like Barbara Hershey or, you know, Tova Felsha on TV, oh, she's Jewish. And when I was maybe 7 or so, she became friendly with Aileen Kaminsky Crum, Robert Crum's wife. They happened to meet at this gym called the Total Woman, where it was mostly peopled by, you know, these women with frosted hair and leotards, and they didn't really look like that. And she would come back sometimes to the house, you know, for a jacuzzi and talk about, you know, her New York Jewish upbringing and her Jewish mother. And I was just captivated by her. I just love that. My mom was really always good about trying to expose me to Jewish role models and Jewish cultural life to the extent that she could.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jennifer Traeg, and her new book is called Devil in the Details, Scenes from an Obsessive Girlhood. Let's talk about some of the kind of typical obsessive-compulsive issues that you had. Like,
yes.
Starting with washing hands, compulsively
yes.
washing your hands. Take me inside your brain for a minute. Like, why do you need to wash your hands so much?
Well, the thinking was that the taint of death was everywhere. That, you know, maybe a hamburger had been on the counter, or maybe, you know, the dog had licked that spot on the linoleum and he had eaten some meat dog food half an hour earlier, or maybe an insect had died. And, you know, if there wasn't a dead bug sitting right there right now, but who knows, probably was there at some point in the past. And as soon as that thought entered my brain would not give me a moment's peace until I got up and washed. So I would go and wash my hands. And then as soon as I sat down again, I would start wondering how well I'd washed my hands. Perhaps the water I had washed them with had contained, you know, a dead shrimp somewhere and, you know, on its way to my faucet. And I would try and fight the urge, and that would last about 30 seconds, and then again I would wash. And then this time maybe I'd worry about the soap I'd use. Maybe it contained lard. Maybe it contained some animal fat. And then wash again, and then another 30 seconds later I'll start thinking about the towel. Who knows what that towel had been used for? Maybe that's tainted. And again I would go. So I could, you know, I was 50, 100 times a day I was at the sink.
And what would happen to your hands after washing so much?
Oh, they were a mess. And I'm blessed with eczema. So, I mean, I had sort of cracked, rashy skin to begin with. And that's, I think, what got me to the doctor in the first place. I had these bloody hands. My parents were very confused.
You know, you write in describing obsessive compulsive behavior, you wrote, "Most obsessive compulsives fear they're going to stab a loved one. Many of us can't bear to be around knives at all. Though we are neither pedophiles or animal lovers, we fear that we're going to rape the baby and the house cat. We worry that we're going to make passes at friends, family members, strangers we find repulsive." Why are you afraid? I mean, what is that fear about? A fear about being around knives, fear about doing damage to people you love?
I think everyone, even people who aren't obsessive compulsive, you know, sometimes has that fear. You're just sitting there and there's that knife and it'll occur to you, there is nothing stopping you from picking that up and going on a stabbing rampage. But I think with obsessive compulsives, the thing is, we can't let that thought go. Everyone has it. But then we'll start mulling it over and over, and suddenly it becomes a possibility. You'd never do it, but you can't let go of the thought, and you can't assure yourself that it actually would never happen.
So most of your obsessive compulsive problems went away after you became a more mature teenager? Is that like around 18 or 19 or something?
Exactly. No one believes that, but it really is true. Sometimes with pediatric OCD, you just outgrow it. And I had a year of pretty intensive therapy. But by the time I started college, I was really ready to leave it behind. And I just did. I thought I was all better until I started doing the research for the book and realized that some things I think of as my charming personality quirks are actually, you know, little obsessive compulsive leftovers, but nothing that gets in the way of my daily life.
What are you thinking of?
I check my keys a lot. I check for my keys. I check for my wallet. I check my locks. And it's not something I spend hours on, but, you know, several times a day, probably a little more than average. And lately I've been thinking I might have trichotillomania by proxy because I'm obsessed with combing my cat, who has a complementary obsession with eating the hair I then brush off. So it seems to work pretty well for the both of us, but I'm probably doing it too much.
So when you say one of your obsessions is locks, like when you leave the house, do you have to go back and make sure you lock the door? Is it that kind of thing?
Yes, I do. I've broken my doorknob several times by jiggling it too hard. So I'm working on that.
My guest is Jennifer Traeg. Her new memoir is called Devil in the Details, Scenes from an Obsessive Girlhood. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jennifer Traeg. Her new memoir is called Devil in the Details, and it's about her adolescent and teen years when she had obsessive-compulsive disorder. Your book is written in a very funny manner, and there's a sense of you standing back, looking at your younger self, and seeing what was going on, comprehending that you had obsessive-compulsive disorder, understanding how you were trapped in that, and yet being able to stand back and laugh at the absurdity of your actions. Were you able to stand back and laugh at all when it was happening?
Yes and no. I mean, to a certain for my family, it was just, you know, it was certainly hard for them, but there were moments that it was just a nonstop laugh riot. You know, you've got a kid wearing Kleenex boxes on her shoes. It's pretty funny. And, you know, at the time, it just drove me crazy. My plastic baggies are not funny, not funny. But at the same time, you know, even then, I was willing to go for the joke if I thought it would get me out of trouble. You know, for my parents, there's no get out of jail free card like a really good one-liner. And I was, even then, was willing to make jokes at my own expense if it meant that they would, you know, leave me alone so I could go wash my hands some more.
What did they try to do to stop you?
They would make a lot of jokes. My mother liked to call me Howard Hughes. That went on for a long time and, you know, offered to, you know, open canned fruit for me and do stuff like that. My sister, you know, would tease me a lot. When it got pretty bad, when it was clear that joking wasn't going to fix this, we tried contracted behavior. At 12, I had to sign a contract stipulating that if I didn't cut this out, and it was very specific about, you know, the behavior that would have to change and included a clause that I would have to use lip gloss every day and condition my hair, not for any aesthetic reason, but because my skin had had cracked and was bleeding because I was, you know, afraid of the taint of death and lip smackers. And that if I did not adhere to all these statutes, all my friends would be told what I was doing. And the thought of, I was 12 at this point, and the thought of junior high ostracization was enough to really keep me aligned. And at the time, that worked.
You know, your book has a pretty ironic, absurd tone through most of it, but the things you write about are really painful, and some of them are really damaging. And your family sounds great. They must have been really frightened about some of your behavior and really worried about you. So what were some of the more serious times like where your parents would express their concern or try to change you or fear that they had done something wrong that was responsible for this disturbing behavior that you were involved with?
Yeah, I mean, certainly by the time I was like 15 or 16, every day was just nonstop crying. I wasn't functional anymore, and they were very worried and, you know, very mean to various doctors and therapists. And at some point we all ended up in family therapy together. And I just remember them, you know, I mean, they were certainly very concerned and wanted desperately for me to get better. But I remember just all of them sort of sitting in this therapist's office like house cats, you know, wondering what they were doing here, that they hadn't caused this. And they hadn't, you know, it was this neurological condition. And it was sort of silly talking about, you know, how we treated each other like that was making my brain do these things. But, you know, they did it because it was the thing to do at the time. I remember my mother at one point when I was really, really bad and just a mess, very kind of scabby from the washing and very, very thin and couldn't really go out in the world. And I remember her holding up my junior prom picture saying, you know, I want this girl back, this happy girl in this strapless dress. And I was thinking, wow, you're crazy. But you know, they just wanted me to be a normal teen, which I would do here and there enough to give them hope.
The tone of your book is pretty comic. You know, you write about the absurdity of your behavior. You write about it with a lot of wit and knowingness. How did you realize that as a writer, you had that kind of sense of humor?
Well, I mean, I think part of it, you know, comes from being raised in a family where nothing was more important than being funny. You know, it was expected you'd get good grades, but there would be no reward for that. But if you were funny, you know, that it was, there was nothing like it, you know, getting a big laugh at the dinner table. Then when I sat down to write this memoir, it was a combination of, you know, mental illness and religion. And if I did it straight, it would be deadly. It would just be the most boring, heaviest, most unpleasant thing in the world. And, you know, so I felt like really the only approach you could take was to keep it pretty light. And actually, you know, for me at this point, it is pretty light. You know, no one died. I'm not scarred for life. It was just, you know, a weird time in my life. I have no regrets about it. So the tone sort of fit how I feel about that time in my life now anyway.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Traeg is the author of the new memoir, Devil in the Details, Scenes from an Obsessive Girlhood.